was discovered by Zinek in 1907, and there was another guy with it, Arnold Sommerfeld. Actually, I made the video about the Sommerfeld. Let me drop it. Cannot patent it. So what they're trying to patent, and that's what is interesting, that's what is into it, is they claim that they have a algorithm that allows to discriminate, or I would say that forbid of unauthorized access to the energy that is sent. So at first, we're dealing with electromagnetic wave. At second, we're dealing with the algorithm or the means, and I believe this is the patent about it. As a matter of fact, I was digging for the past 3 weeks and I couldn't find their patent. But the $500 million was invested, and there are a number of high-ranked generals and big companies in it. Really big, big, huge businesses that are interested in it. So, once they put the energy into the electromagnetic waves, and since this is a frequency from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz at most, they're trying to only give that electricity to the people who bought the access to it. But eventually, the cost of delivery, they consider it to be minimal and to exchange.
AC2GS, that's all well and good, Wesley. The problem is they've never actually, no one's discovered or proved Zenek waves. Zenek waves is a proposed solution to a mathematical set of Maxwell's equations, and that's all it's ever been. There's been lots of promises that it doesn't follow the square law that electromagnetism is supposed to, and a lot of other strange things, but no one's ever made any to anyone who could test it. So as far as I know, Zenek waves are kind of fringe things. And I don't know how you encrypt energy. You can encrypt information. You can't really encrypt energy. So I can't perceive of any way other than physically locking energy sources. So if you're going to spread out electromagnetic waves, you're going to be able to suck on them, if you will. So I don't know. This is a little bit too high blue sky for me at this point. So I really would like to kind of get back to the science articles if I can.
No problem. Thank you very much. I just mentioned that. Thank you for telling me. You can send me the link to the recording when you touch the bases with it. It is kind of phenomena, and I'm interested with that. And to extend, thank you very much.
This is DPC with a comment.
Okay, Wesley, I will find that segment in the past archives, and I will send it to you. But let me move on to the next article. I don't want to get too bogged down with any one topic. So let me break for a moment, and then we'll move on to a new exciting article.
Well, it's K6DPZ. I'd like to make a comment.
Well, we spoke about Sotheby's auction house in the past weeks, but if you aren't a fan of overpriced art, perhaps an overpriced rock might interest you. Have you ever wanted to own a piece of the moon? Well, this might finally be your chance. If you have $1 million lying around, next month, Sotheby's in New York will auction off some of the only moon rocks that can be legally owned by private individuals. The three moon rocks were first obtained by the unmanned Soviet Luna 16 mission in 1970 and were given by the Soviet government to Nina Ivanova Korolev, widow of Sergei Pavlovich Korolev, head rocket engineer in the Soviet space program during the 1950s and the 60s. The Lunar 16 mission was the first time that the Soviet Union obtained lunar samples, and it was just the third time ever following Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 missions by the Americans. Let me drop for a second. The lunar samples last sold at auction in 1993, where they went for $442,500 to an anonymous buyer. It was the first time that a piece of another world had been offered for sale. But it wasn't even the most expensive item at that time. A Soyuz TM-10 space capsule from that same auction was sold for $1.6 million. This time around, the moon rocks are expected to go for anywhere from $700,000 to $1 million. Now, legally, any moon rocks obtained by NASA can't be privately owned, but these were nabbed by the Soviet government and were legally presented to a private individual, which makes their ownership legally, perfectly legal. Sotheby explained just how rare these rocks are. They said authentic lunar samples available public acquisition may be qualified as extremely rare, as titles to lunar samples remain with the entities that collected them, that being the United States during Apollo's 11 to 17 missions and the USSR, succeeded by the Russian Federation via the Luna 16, Luna 20, and Luna 24 missions, as well as with the countries gifted with the Apollo 11 samples and the Apollo 17 Goodwill moon rocks on behalf of the Nixon administration. These samples are subject to laws governing public gifts, and in most cases, as in the United States, the law does not allow for public gifts to be transferred to an individual. As such, this is the only known documented lunar sample to have been gifted to a private individual. Let me drop for a second. The auction will take place on November 29th, 2018. As part of a larger space exploration auction. There will be a public exhibition opening on November 25th, where the rare moon rocks will be on display in New York. So break out that piggy bank that you've been saving for some shack acquisition and see if you have enough saved for this purchase of a lifetime. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
K6DPZ. Look at you, weasel. Why don't you let me on? I hold a PhD. Maybe you do the same. Hello, Chrissy, okay?
Okay, no one wants to buy a moon rock. Let's move on to the next thing. You say the price of those Russian moon rocks are a bit too much for your bank account? Has that timesharing plan to own a piece of the Brooklyn Bridge fallen through for you? Well, consider investing in a few kilos of Martian dirt instead. The University of Central Florida is selling Martian dirt, $20 a kilogram plus shipping. This is not fake news. A team of UCF astrophysicists has developed a scientifically based, standardized method for creating Martian and asteroid soil known as simulants. The team published its findings this month in the journal Icarus. The simulant is useful for research as we look to go to Mars, says the physics professor Dan Britt, a member of UCF's Planetary Science Group. If we are going to go, we'll need food, water, and other essentials. As we are developing solutions, we pray to test how these ideas will fare. For example, scientists looking for ways to grow food on Mars, cue the Martian movie, need to test their techniques on soil that most closely resembles that stuff on Mars. Let me drop for a second. You wouldn't want to discover that your method didn't work when we are actually there, Britt said. What would you do then? It takes years to get there, and what do you do then? UCF's formula is based on the chemical signature of the soil on Mars collected by the Curiosity rover. Britt built two calibration targets that were part of Curiosity's rover. Researchers currently use simulants that aren't standardized, so any experiment can't be compared to any other in an apples-to-apples kind of way, Britt said. As a geologist and a physicist, he knows his dirt. Like a recipe, the ingredients can be mixed in different ways to mimic soil from different objects, including asteroids and planets. And because the formula is based on scientific methods and is published for all to use, even those not ordering through UCF can create dirt that can be used for experiments, which reduces the uncertainty level. Kevin Cannon, the paper's lead author and a postdoctoral researcher who works with Britt at UCF, says there are different types of soil on Mars and on asteroids. On Earth, for example, we have black sand, white sand, clay, topsoil, to name just a few. On the other worlds, you might find carbon-rich soils, soils, salt-rich soils, he added. With this technique, we can produce many variations, Cannon said. Most of the minerals we need are found on Earth, although some are very difficult to obtain. Cannon is in Montana to collect ingredients for a moon simulant this week. Moon and asteroid materials are rare and expensive on Earth, since they arrived via meteorites in small amounts. That's why asteroids and moon simulants are also a list of items that can be ordered. The UCF team can mimic most ingredients and will substitute for any potentially harmful materials. All simulants produced in the lab meet NASA's safety standards. Let me drop for a second. Brick and Cannon believe there is a market for the simulants, a $20 kilogram plus shipping. It may be easier to send UCF an order and then try and make it in labs than to make it in labs across the nation. The team already has about 30 pending orders, including one from Kennedy Space Center for a half a ton of the stuff. For Cody Schultz, a mechanical engineering senior, getting to work on the experimental soil has been very cool for him. For someone who has always loved space science, this is the ultimate cool, he said, and the experience is fantastic in terms of the real out-of-this-world experience. Maybe we can arrange a group order for the club, eh? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2, GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
When Jet Propulsion Laboratory practices with the rovers, Mars rovers, they have this test bed and it's filled with all the simulated Martian dirt. It's duplicated, you know, exactly what Curiosity or Opportunity is involved in. So they have a bunch of that there, but I guess this is more refined and more chemically accurate than what they're using. You know, they have it set up. Let's say their rover gets caught, stuck because the wheels are slipping, you know, so they have an exact duplication of the situation that they have there. They can change the angle of the, you know, the ground and the dirt, duplicate what's really going on Mars. Back to you, Roy.
Well, yeah, I could understand that they could have the facilities to sort of brew their own. The Kennedy Space Center apparently ordered half a ton of the stuff from these guys at UCF. So I think it's more a matter of standardizing so that everyone out there, including the big boys, are using the same general mix so that their results can make some sense with each other. I think that's the big plus in this type of a picture of something that's standardized. A couple of weeks ago, I did a story on graphene, and one of the problems with the experiments was that the available manufactured samples are so erratic, different, and some of them barely contain any graphene in them. So you want a manufacturer, in this case a college-based manufacturer, that kind of stands behind it with quality and repeatability.
And there's a big difference, you know, 500 pounds compared to what they have. They must have tons of this stuff, you know. It covers a large area. Back to you, Roy.
Well, yeah. Again, these are the big guys, so they can afford to bring their own stuff. But, you know, Joe Lab may not be able to, may feel more comfortable with just buying it from the UCF and at least being able to write up the research with a standardized test that other people can order and repeat the experiment and hopefully get the same results, and if not, try and figure out what went wrong.
Very well. Continue on, Roy.
Okay, very good. For my next story, I have a little puzzle, because I always like puzzles, and I always like involving people in puzzles. So I ask the listening audience to please play along with me. What do you think is the deadliest animal known to mankind?
Man.
That's a very, very good one, and there are some years where that might qualify as an answer, but generally, year in and year out, Is there something even more dangerous than mankind to mankind?
I would say the mamba snake.
Okay, it certainly is a deadly animal, and it's bitten people. But really, if you add up how many people it's killed, say, in the last year, it wouldn't really amount to any. It would pale in comparison to guns or cars or a whole bunch of things. I know we're talking about animals alone. But generally, yes, it is a deadly animal, but the combination is a deadly animal that gets to actually kill people. So, anyone else with any ideas of what might be the deadliest animal out there?
I'll go with the polar bear.
Okay, Paul, polar bear, again, a good choice. The trick, if you will, to this is it has to be something that's all over the place and has easy access to people to kill them. So that's kind of, you know, I mean, how many times are you in a situation where you're next to a polar bear?
Mankind.
Yes, that was already offered, and again, there are some years, unfortunately, where you could say that. But you may say that even after I tell the little story here, but... You know, with the exception of humanity killing itself, let's take them out of the equation and ask if there's any other animal who is as deadly to themselves and to others as mankind is. How's that?
Major Jackson.
Here you.
There was a bunch of people doubling. Jack Sam.
WB2GXM Rich. I will go with poisonous snakes.
By the number, mosquito. There will be number of people killed.
Tyria.
Wesley was right. But now let me tell you the story that this one is connected with. Let me drop for a second, and then I'll tell you my little story on this. Okay, far more lethal than sharks, wolves, bears, or any other fanged beast is a tiny mosquito, which holds the title of the world's deadliest animal. The World Health Organization estimates that millions of people die every single year from mosquito-borne diseases. Thankfully, scientists have come up with a strategy to greatly reduce the mosquito population, but it requires sending tens or even hundreds of thousands of mosquitoes to different areas of the world, often through the mail. You might assume that you'd need a rather large package to ship those thousands of mosquitoes, but a new study has found that you can actually compress these pests into a ridiculously tiny space, and they'll still stay alive. They even survive the trip better than mosquitoes packed loosely. How tiny, you ask? Well, according to the researchers behind the new study, published this past Wednesday in the Journal of Insect Science, the magic number is somewhere around 240 mosquitoes per cubic centimeter. That amounts to around 1,200 mosquitoes in a single teaspoon and up to 2,500 in a 10cc syringe. Another way to picture it is there's that 7,200 living mosquitoes can be packed into a one-ounce shot glass. Let me drop for a second.
For an animal, not an insect.
Yes, George, but insects are animals.
But they're not.
I'm sorry, George, they are. A bacteria. They're not plants. And they're not fungus. Those are the kingdoms. They're in the animal kingdom. A team led by researchers from New Mexico State University came to this calculation after conducting a series of lab and real-world experiments, including sending the insects through overnight mail. They were hoping to figure out the best way to use these pesky bloodsuckers to save lives. In the 1950s, scientists devised a clever way to eradicate dangerous insects without using pesticides, called the sterile insect technique. You basically breed a giant population of male insects in the lab. You sterilize them without harming them otherwise, and then you release them into the wild, hoping that they'll breed with the females. Over time, as the intact males are crowded out of the mating game, the females lay eggs that never reach maturity, and the whole population dwindles. Let me drop for a second. The first insect this was tried with to great success was the screwworm fly. Since then, the technique has been used to eradicate populations of various fruit flies and moths. And nowadays, researchers, include scientists behind the latest studies, are eagerly beginning to test out whether it can work for the deadliest animal around, the mosquito. A problem using this technique, though, is male mosquitoes are really, really lazy. They don't particularly like to fly much. Over a lifetime, they'll fly up to about 100 meters, maybe 200 meters, but not much more. Now, because of this laziness, the eradication campaigns will need to get the sterile mosquitoes as close to the action as possible, if you know what I mean. Using aerial drones might help, but they'll still need to make sure that they're stored, packaged, and released safely, without accidentally killing or maiming them. So, this team conducted experiments in the lab, hoping to find the ideal shipping conditions for the mosquitoes. They tested a variety of temperatures to keep the insects sluggish. They also tested how tightly they could pack mosquitoes into various syringe sizes. Then they took these things one step further and mailed thousands of bugs from New Mexico to their colleagues all over the place. The mosquitoes were generally fine with being kept chilled at a wide range of temperatures, although 57.2 degrees Fahrenheit appeared to be ideal. And in the lab, it initially didn't seem like there was any major difference in the survival rates when it came to how tightly they were packed, but things changed in the live test. Let me drop for a second.
E2FIU.
George?
Insect. Animal. Plant.
I'm afraid not. Anyway, it turns out that the highly compacted mosquitoes survived the trip better than the loosely packed ones. They did this because the vibrations of the plane damaged the loosely packed mosquitoes. The team next plans to test out their theory that vibrations cause more deaths in the loosely packed groups. They also hope to conduct live trials of shipped mosquitoes to ensure that the cramped arrangements aren't cramping the mosquitoes' mating prowess. And if you're wondering, yes, it is quite legal to send mosquitoes and bugs through the U.S. Postal Service, so long as you follow their rules. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2, GS. Okay, we're off mosquitoes. On to another subject. We've spoken before about the looming opioid crisis. Opioids are a group of very effective painkillers that have been with us in one form or another for at least 6,000 years of mankind's history. Images of opium poppies have been found in ancient Sumerian artifacts. First uses opium, extracted directly from the opium poppy by making cuts on its seed pod and collecting the latex material that oozes out. Its name comes directly from ancient Greek that used it and called it opion. The black rubbery gum was often burned and the smoke inhaled for less than medicinal purposes, but starting in the 1600s, sometimes the latex was dissolved in alcohol, producing something called a tincture of opium or laudanum that you might have heard about. And that was used for all kinds of pain relief, both physical and emotional. Now, the active ingredient in opium is morphine. It was successfully extracted from opium and purified starting around the early 19th century, and it was a very effective painkiller during the Civil War. Pharmaceutical companies went looking for a less addictive form of morphine and came up with something that they branded heroin. Unfortunately, it was twice as potent as morphine, and even more addictive, and it was discontinued as a legal commercial product and has gone on to become an infamous illegal problem just by itself. Let me drop for a second. There are different varieties of opium poppies in our world. A variety with little or no actual morphine produced is used to supply those poppy seeds on your poppy seed bagels, and it isn't just an old false urban tale. If you eat a lot of poppy seed bagels, your urine can test falsely positive for opioid use. Medicinal opium poppies are grown in Asia, Central, and South America. Opioids are within a class of molecules called alkaloids. These alkaloids operate by binding to so-called opiate receptors in our brain and our peripheral nervous system. Those receptors can be found all the way back to the earliest of vertebrates, and in one form or another are used to mediate the effects of our naturally produced opioids, which are often called endorphins, which actually stands for endogenous morphine. Opioids do their magic by activating our opiate receptors in our central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. This can deaden pain sensitivity, diminish cough reflexes, and by flooding our brain with the neurotransmitter called dopamine, cause a much too enjoyable side effect known as euphoria. Let me drop for a second. Our brain doesn't need much of this alkaloid to produce this euphoria for the first time, but our brain does become more and more used to its effect, and the dosage to reach the same initial effects, unfortunately, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, as do the risks of fatal side effects. It is the side effects of this euphoria that has driven the opioid crisis to this critical point. The number of opioid prescriptions filled in the United States peaked in 2012 to 282 million prescriptions that year, and has since declined to only 238 million prescriptions as far as 2016. During 2017, it's believed that 49,068 people died of opioid overdoses in the United States, and that approximately 130 people die of this every single day of the year. It's believed that over 46% of these deaths are related to one relatively new synthetic opioid called fentanyl. Let me drop for a second. Opioids come in a lot of different variations. One of the latest versions, as I mentioned before, is called fentanyl. It is fully synthetic, originally developed as a powerful anesthetic for surgery, but it is also administered to alleviate severe pain associated with terminal illnesses like cancers. The drug is up to 100 times more powerful than morphine. Just a small dose can be deadly. Illicitly produced fentanyl has been a driving factor in the number of overdose deaths in the recent years. Now, in the past year, the government has taken some measures to deal with this crisis. There have been new initiatives to stop opioid abuse. There have been $6 billion allotted for opium programs in 2018, and another $3 billion were allotted for 2019. But the FDA has just approved a shiny new opioid for medical use. This new wonder drug has been christened Dysuvia, or its chemical name, Sufentanil. It is 1,000 times more potent than good old morphine and 10 times stronger than even fentanyl. The painkiller Dysuvia will be restricted to limited use only in healthcare settings such as hospitals, surgery centers, and emergency rooms, but critics worry that the opioid will fuel another grim opioid epidemic. Dysuvia will not be available at retail pharmacies or for any home use. The medication, which comes in a single-use package, also should not be used for more than 72 hours. The medicine comes in a tablet that can be dissolved under the tongue. Side effects of this drug include extreme tiredness, breathing problems, coma, and death. For some reason, I just don't think this drug's approval is going to help this mess. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Into wheel.
How do you spell that? The super...
Dysuvia is the brand name. The chemical name is Sufentanil. That's spelled Sufentanil.
Okay, yes.
Yes, Richie.
Yeah, it sounded like you were saying this. Yeah, you know, like it was starting with the letter D, but it's the letter S. Very good.
Well, it depends. It's a very badly named... The brand name is spelled D-S-U-V-I-A, so the best I could guess is Dysuvia. The chemical name is Sufentanil, but the brand name that the marketing people came up is Dysuvia. D and S don't strike me as the first two letters of any word.
Okay, yeah, it sounded like you were saying it was the word was starting with a D. I got it.
Hey, very good. So, Richie, you wanted to speak up for opioids?
Oh, boy. Because of my Tourette syndrome, they always give me each month a prescription for either Ativan or Xanax. They work for me equally. You know, it's a one-month prescription that's non-renewable because the government is involved. Being that the government is involved, do you think they'll ever discontinue it? Because I use it as per prescription, and I really need it.
Richie, neither of those medications are opioids.
Again, Ron?
Say again, I couldn't make out your response.
Did you say they're not opioids?
Yes, Rich, they're not opioids. They're related to Valium-like agents. They're sedatives, but they're not opiates. They're controlled substances. They're addictive, but they're not opiates.
Okay, so I assume when you're saying the federal government will not get their hands and play doctor again. By the way, I'll give you some other information you may or may not know. You know why Coca-Cola is called Coca-Cola? Back in the 1950s, it actually contained a small amount of cocaine. I know that because when I would get sick, I was always sickly. The doctor would tell my mother to go over to the pharmacy and get it was all in a bag, a little cocaine. And she would give me that as per what the doctor said. And of course, can't do that now.
And Richie, that's probably a very good thing. It's a very effective stimulant. Again, it's highly addictive and in large dosages can lead to a lot of terrible things, irregular heartbeats, heart attacks, strokes, all kinds of nasty things. We let a lot of things be sold over the counter. As I was mentioning earlier, the pharmaceutical companies were concerned about opium use, so they gave us heroin, which you could buy at a drugstore without a doctor's prescription, and that didn't work out well at all. Even as far as the 1970s, there was the occasional physician who would mix his B12 energy shots with a little cocaine just to give it that little extra lift. My understanding, though, is that although Coca-Cola started with the use of coca leaves that had a minuscule amount of cocaine in them, over the years, they did away with the cocaine. They removed it. So I doubt that there was any actual cocaine in Coca-Cola for much of this last 100 years.
I think that was in the 30s, not the 50s.
I would agree. That's
it. I was born in 1950. I was always sickly. The pediatrician would tell my mother to buy coke syrup from the pharmacy. So that's what,
you know, a whole bunch of stimulants.
You said Valium, Ativac, rather Ativan, Xanax. What type of medication is that? It's not an opiate. What is it? What class?
It's in the same family as Valium. They're all central nervous system depressants. They depress you. So people who become anxious and such, it calms them down. And in some cases, for short-acting versions, it's been used and abused as a sleeping aid.
Amy 2LMC.
Yeah, boy. Well, I don't abuse it. The doctor gave me a prescription every month. When I renew it, it's 3 times a day as needed. Sometimes I take none. Sometimes I take 1 or 2. And sometimes I need 3. So I certainly don't use abuse.
Okay, Rich. I mean, medication is not inherently all bad. It's not inherently all good. As I often use the example, a hammer is a very useful tool. You can build a house with one. You could also cave in your neighbor's skull. So you can abuse things, misuse things, kill people with things, or it can help. There's a reason why it's prescribed, not because it's a poison and dangerous, but because it has some benefits. You just have to be aware of it. Now, I heard the tail end of a call sign. I believe it was ALC, if you had a comment or a question.
Hi, Tony here, KB2OMC. That syrup for Coca-Cola was used for nausea and emesis vomiting way back in the day, by the way.
I mean, people found a lot of medicinal uses for things that were ever so slightly dubious. You know, things work. Dextromethorphan is a decent cough suppressant. If you take too much of it, and kids have been known to guzzle the stuff, it can make you sick and give you other problems. So, you know, it soothes you, but I don't know. I mean, in the end, I don't think Coca-Cola has been a boon to our health, personally, but, you know, maybe dentists have a different opinion.
No, they gave it to me in the 50s, boy. For sore throat. And it worked. But my mother was in control when I was a little boy because the doctor told her how much and when.
Hey, Rich. I mean, like I said before, I don't think it was in the Coca-Cola, the drink in the... It still was very possibly available at the pharmacy under a prescription. This was back in the good old days when there was no such thing as controlled substances and you didn't need triplicate forms. And now we've gone beyond triplicate forms. In New York State, I cannot pretty much write a prescription for anything anymore. I have to go through a computer system to get anything prescribed. So we live in weird times. I don't know if it's really changing crisis at all, that I have to enter it through a multiply protected computer screen, but we'll see what happens. But something's got to be done with it because there's way too many people sitting up dead in emergency rooms.
I realize that, boy. I just resent the fact that the government is playing doctor. I think the doctors should be, they're aware. They should be, my doctor should be able to write a prescription for Xanax, Ativan, and just be respectful of keeping records. So, a couple of times I ran out short, and he said his hands were tied. I know his hands were tied. That's not right. And what the doctor told my mother when I was a little boy, a pediatrician told her to go to the pharmacy and get Coke syrup to soothe my sore throat.
Okay, Richie. I mean, no one is above the law. I would like doctors to be above the law. It would probably be loads of fun. But no one in this country is above the law. And we're all subject to regulations and hopefully have a voice in making those regulations. And unfortunately, there are some physicians who have turned to the dark side of the force. There are guys out there who have written, you know, some ridiculous thing like 20 or 30% of all the opiates written in their area are written by one guy. Either they're very unfortunate and having a lot of people dying of cancer and severe intractable, or there's something funny going on. So, you know, we all... It all works out better if we all kind of keep an eye on each other, if you will.
Now I understand, boy. That kind of medicine is not right when somebody is writing all those prescriptions for a controlled substance. In my case, I just feel sorry, very uneasy, that I have to wait sometimes to renew it. I don't think that's right. I think my doctor should be allowed to practice medicine, not the DEA.
Thank Obama.
Now, let's stay away from politics, please. We have enough reasons to be upset.
Without Obama, the sir who mentioned that, it was long before that, right, boy?
No, it wasn't.
Again, not going to touch politics with a 10-foot pole on this net. But usually there's something going on. If the doctor wrote a prescription for X number of pills for Y number of days and you're trying to fill it earlier, it could be the legal system, but it's much more likely to just be the insurance system saying you're trying to sneak something by us. According to this, you're supposed to have enough medicine for another week. We're not going to pay unless we know what the hell happened to those missing pills. I mean, unfortunately, I can tell you endless hard luck stories that people have come to me who needed controlled substances where they would come back every week. One week, their mother threw them into the garbage. The next week, their cousin stole them from them. They all have wonderful excuses, but, you know, that's what people addicted to drugs and manipulative people tend to do. So, unfortunately, you're in the other situation, and I'm sorry for that, but, you know, we live in weird times. What can I tell you? But please, no politics on the tech net.
Oh, I agree, boy. No politics. But, I think, like I say, the order of the doctors practice medicine. But what you're saying is true. I was told by my doctor if anything goes missing, which it hasn't, to call the police first. And then he can write another prescription. That's the way it's done. He can't just do it on his own. Police have to take a report and then get to him. Then he can write a prescription.
He's telling you exactly the truth. I mean, I once had people doing repairs in my office, and the next day I have a numbered, that was before it was electronic, I had a numbered prescription pad, and I noticed that someone had lifted one prescription out of every five out of the pad. So you call the cops and you let them know.
That's fine. You know, when I came home from the hospital one day, I bought my medication. I thought they'd want to see him, which they did. They locked him away, and when I got him back, everything was there except the Ativan. So we had a drug addict, obviously, in the hospital. I couldn't do anything about it.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Rich. You know, unfortunately, there are bad people all over the place. You know, hopefully over time they'll grow less, but I've never seen that actually happen. But, you know, what can you do? Anyway, I just want to thank everyone who's participated and involved themselves in this science talk tonight. I want to remind them again that the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And also that if you want to see pictures of Oumuamua and links to the things that I mentioned, just go to the website roy.ac2gs.com. And I want to thank Dick for giving me the opportunity and hand it over to Paul for the space report.
Very good, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, and I wanted to see if they wanted to say something first.
Yeah, KD2PPF. Yeah, I believe Oumuamua is real. So, yeah, the trajectory alone is pretty crazy. So, back to that. Sorry, guys. Just had to chime in again.
Very good. Okay. First of all, question to you, Roy. Are you going to post that one video about the electron rocket that took off that I sent to you?
I posted a link to the web page that you linked to, so they just have to click and go down it and and select the video, unless you want me to arrange specifically opens up to that video.
That would probably be better. You could, I don't know. I just sent it over. Wasn't too sure if you were going to put it on, because sometimes they have advertisements, and you might not want that. That's what's good about NASA. With NASA, you can just send anything over, but if it's a commercial site, then you never know what you're sending over with it. Very good. In any case, what I'm speaking about is an Electron rocket that took off last night, from New Zealand. The Electron rocket is a rocket built by a company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is owned by a fellow named Peter Beck, who got involved with this company starting in 2006. From 2006 until just about a year or so ago, he actually went from concept to orbital flight. So Rocket Lab put the Electron rocket into orbit about a year and a couple months ago. What happened was the first one failed to make orbit, and the second one did make orbit. And then now he considers the Electron rocket operational, calling it ready for business. He's got some name like that attached to it. So he's going to go into 1 month, every month he'll launch a rocket, and he'll eventually get it down to two or even three times a month. That's the plan. Sending small satellites, CubeSats, into orbit. Now, on this flight, he sends seven CubeSats into orbit. Now, this rocket's interesting in the design of the rocket. Electric motors to power these turbine engines. Anytime you have a rocket, you need a tremendous amount of fuel and oxygen to be pumped into the combustion chamber. And, you need to spin these things up sometimes to 100,000 RPM. And all other rockets go with sometimes an exhaust type of system or some kind of the actual steam setup like the Russians do. But this guy wanted to go with a closed system, so he's using electric motors to spin up the turbine.
Paul, just for a second, there's a little bit of hiss in the background. You're a little weaker than normal tonight. Could you try aiming your antenna a couple of degrees to the right and a couple of degrees to the left and tell me where it is? Because I think there's a better setting where you'd be giving us a little bit less noise. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, well, this is more power. How's this?
And that's the brute force approach. I think it's an aiming problem. Try a little bit of aiming. Go back to the power you were at and try a little bit of clockwise, a little bit of counterclockwise aiming, and I think the noise will go away. Go ahead.
Okay, I moved it a few degrees. How's this?
And what I'm recommending you do is go 2 degrees to the right, 2 more degrees to the right, and 2 degrees to the left, 2 more degrees to the left. Continuously transmitting, and tell us where you are while you're doing it, and then we'll find that spot real fast. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Going up to around 300, 310. Now I'm going to go down to 300. Going to 290, 280, 70, and now 260. How's that?
I think 270 is the ideal position. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. We're back to 270. How's that thing?
Quite good. A little bit of hiss in the background, but it's okay. You're 95% audio, 5% hiss. Go ahead.
Okay, now I'm back on high power. I can leave it on high power. Just leave the fan on. How's that?
Sounds very good.
Yeah, okay. I know the signals were a little bit down today, so earlier tonight I put it on through a different repeater. So, okay, the Electron rocket has 9 engines in first stage and 9 electric motors and 9 ion batteries, 9 inverters to run these electric motors. Each electric motor runs 50 horsepower for each one. So there's nine at the base of this thing. The rocket is not that big. The rocket is only about 8 feet in diameter, and it's only 58 feet tall. But with that, he's able to get it off the pad. Second stage eventually comes on after about 2 minutes after the first stage drops away. It's not reusable, so it goes into the Pacific Ocean. And then that second stage pushed the payload to orbit. The bearings came off, and the payload was set loose, and it's slightly spinning. And at that point, it starts releasing seven CubeSats. And from what I understand, they were all successful. So I bring this up, we always talk about the larger rockets, you know, the Falcon 9 or the Falcon 9 Heavy or the Atlas 5 or the Delta 4 and the Delta 4 Heavy. But these are smaller ones. This could be the wave of the future for all these small satellites that they want to put into orbit. Literally thousands of satellites, either by this company or this half a dozen other companies that would like to do the same thing. This one is just the first one out of the box. So Rocket Lab has set up their own launch complex in New Zealand. This rocket was launched from New Zealand, the North Island. You have two big islands in New Zealand. Set this launch complex up, and that was successful. Last month, he made arrangements with Wallops Island, Virginia. Wallops Island, Virginia is not too far from us, and we have a launch complex over there, and presently they launch rockets for NASA. The orbital ATK, now it's Northrop Grumman that launches the Antares rocket from Wallops Island. On top of the Antares rocket, they send the Cygnus spacecraft, which has the cargo for the International Space Station. So now they have contracted with the Wallops Island to build their own launch complex side by side with Antares. So it's going to be, I think, a launch complex zero, I think they call it 1A. And it'll be their second launch complex, one in New Zealand and one here. They operate out of California. The company is registered with United States, and all these engines are built in California and shipped to New Zealand presently. So I predict like next month he should be able to get his next rocket off, and one right after the other. You know, probably for the first year, he'll be happy to get one rocket off per month, and maybe eventually two per month. And then from the United States, he's really only planning one per month from Wallops Island. So that won't take place until the launch complex is built roughly a little over a year from now. So probably toward the end of, very end of next year, he might get his first flight out of Virginia. But with all these satellites, there's companies that send small satellites just to take pictures of the Earth. Some of them are still doing studies for global warming. And then the biggest one is going to be thousands of these satellites that are going to be needed for internet connections. And there's about two or three companies looking to do that. This guy is going to be one of the people sending them up. When it got up to orbit, he even built the third engine, the third stage. It's really a kick motor, and he calls it the Curie, named after Madame Curie, and so he builds everything: launch complex, first stage, second stage, the kick motor, and even the deployment vehicle that deployed the seven CubeSats. Like one of the CubeSats was Irvine. Irvine comes out of Irvine, California, and it's going to be a satellite that's going to take pictures of Venus and stars. It's part of the STEM educational program, and he's got an actual goal of perfecting the distances, not only to the planets, but to the stars. So they're doing a study on that. The six public high schools put this together in Irvine, California, and they wound up with a launch. Now, to launch the whole rocket, not the seven satellites, but the rocket itself, is around $5 million. Bad as your SpaceX, which is really the cheapest one around, and that's one big rocket for $65 million. So this guy could dramatically cut the cost down. Yes, it's true that the rockets are not reusable, but he doesn't care. They're all inexpensively made using carbon bodies. Carbon, it's not even metal. So carbon epoxy fiber. And they run regular fuel, RP-1 fuel, which is really kerosene and liquid oxygen. A couple of other satellites that went up. One thing that was launched by Fleet Space Technologies. Fleet Space Technologies is one of the companies that would like to put up an internet system with hundreds of satellites. The first two, and this company comes out of Australia, so good luck to that group. That's another one that I haven't heard of until this particular flight. SpaceX wants to do it, and one or two others. Maybe 4, 5, 6 years from now, we'll have choice of, instead of going with Cablevision or Viacom, maybe we'd go with Space Internet. Other small rocket companies that will be doing this will be like Vector Launch Company. They plan on launching out of Georgia, Cameron, Georgia, right near the coast. They've tested suborbital flights, and now they probably will get their first orbital flight up next year. Virgin Orbit, of course. Virgin Orbit is a subsidiary of Virgin Galactic. And Virgin Galactic is the one company Richard Branson owns that will eventually be putting crews into space, pilot and co-pilot, probably next year, and probably also next year if that goes well, he'll be able to send up paying passengers. Well, one of the companies that he spun off from Virgin Galactic is something called Virgin Orbit. Virgin Orbit is taking a 747, and they rigged it to bring up a rocket that would be able to go to orbit. The rocket's called the Launcher 1, and he's already tested this thing, attached it to the wing, make sure everything fits, and if all goes well, within another month or so, I think he's going to be able to have his first launch with, or at least test launch with Launcher 1, dropping it from 747 at 35,000 feet. Another company which is called Relatively Space, don't know much about it, but they're into 3D printing rockets. Firefly Aerospace, they've had a test flight, suborbital flight from New Mexico. They'll be doing the same thing. These will all be low Earth orbital flights. Another company also from Australia that would like to come online within about a year or so. So you can imagine all these thousands of satellites flying around. They have to know where they are in space. You have to know when you launch, you're not going to go up and hit one. The logistics behind all this is probably going to be mind-boggling. You know, who's going to keep track of it? Are all the countries going to be paying one company to keep track of it like we do with Intelsat? Who knows? We'll have to find out as time goes on. Okay, a couple other flights coming up this Thursday. They're launching an Antares rocket from Wallops Island, the launch complex area in Virginia I just mentioned before. And on top of the Antares, they'll be launching a Cygnus spacecraft going up to the International Space Station to resupply it. Still presently, they do have only three astronauts on board the space station. the other three haven't gone up yet, but since the Russians believe they have a handle on what went wrong last time when they tried to send the other two up, they should be sending, instead of two, three up to the space station in early December. They actually pushed the flight earlier instead of later. We'll see if the Soyuz makes it off the ground at that time. But before that flight, you have another one November 14th, which